clapping, and if a tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound? Now, those koan are so familiar that it's easy to overlook the primary insight, which is that your rational mind is a source of confusion rather than enlightenment. So let me give you a non-Zen example. If you've ever had a golf lesson or a tennis lesson or a batting practice in baseball, you've probably heard something like swing through the ball. Now, rationally, that's absurd. The bat, the club, the racket, they do not go through the ball. And basic physics tells us that as soon as you lose contact with the ball, nothing you do can have any effect on the ball. So why does imagining the counterfactual swing through the ball work? Well, it seems that that's the only way we can put full power into the swing and not stop too soon. The only way we can do that is to delude ourselves. If you think rationally about the physics of the process, you will play less well. You need to trick yourself into swinging through something. So imagine that insight applied to every aspect of life. Just try that golf trick on everything. But here's a commercial example. Don't try to hit your sales target. Swing through the target. Zen monastic life isn't commercial, but it tries to infuse a sort of simple, unconscious rhythm into everything. Preparing meals, eating meals, gardening, housekeeping. All those things should be done with awareness, but not an aggressive sense of intention. Now, if you've ever had an especially great day playing a sport, a musical instrument, or maybe even just cooking, and felt that strange effortlessness, that's the goal of Zen practice. Now, let me highlight something that might be obvious. Zen is a very appealing approach to Buddhism for warriors. That idea of a calm and collected mind, a state of mind that makes you more able to execute complex physical tasks, that's crucial for a warrior. Because if you're a swordsman, a bad day on the links might mean you die. So clearly, Zen meditative practice would have had a powerful appeal to the samurai class. Samurai class that had begun to wield authority in Japan in the latter part of the 12th century. And here again, as with Pure Land Buddhism, we see a connection between the religious atmosphere in medieval Japan and the political change that's taking place. Now, Zen and Pure Land are in many ways extremely different Buddhist traditions. Zen, with its focus on nirvana through a quiet mind, and Pure Land with its focus on salvation through faith. But both are actually similar in terms of broader social change, because both reflect the decline of the imperial court and the shift of power away from an aristocracy in Kyoto. Both schools sought to bring Buddhism to a new audience.
Lecture 9, Samurai Culture in the Ashikaga Period.
People often talk about the samurai, or the samurai code, in a completely anachronistic fashion. As though samurai culture were fixed and unchanging. As though the warriors behaved the same way in 1800 as in 1100. But of course, warrior culture changed a lot over those seven centuries. And that's one of my preoccupations as a historian. Putting a sense of historical change into samurai culture, thinking about how samurai culture changed, especially as a part of broader changes in Japanese society. So today, let's look at the evolution of warrior culture in the centuries after the first shogunate was created by Minamoto no Yoritomo. Now, between 1185 and 1868, three different dynasties would use the title shogun, which we can roughly translate as generalissimo. The first shogunal dynasty was the Minamoto, with their capital in Kamakura, from 1185 to 1333. The second was the Ashikaga dynasty, with its capital in the Muromachi neighborhood of Kyoto. The textbook dates for the Muromachi are 1336 to 1573. But that's with a big caveat, because for the last 100 years, the Ashikaga shoguns were almost powerless. And then came the Tokugawa dynasty, from 1603 to 1868, with its capital in Edo, which today we call Tokyo. Now, in all three dynasties, the rulers claimed descent from Minamoto no Yoritomo, even though those connections were extremely remote. But in Japanese tradition, those remote connections were important. For example, remember how in the 500s, the 25th emperor was succeeded not by his son, or his grandson, or even a nephew, but by a descendant of his great-great-great-grandfather? Now, you could treat a connection that remote as the creation of a new dynasty. In fact, some historians treat that moment as a break in the imperial line. But the official imperial genealogy insists that that was just one part of a direct line of descent from the sun goddess Amaterasu. So Japanese shoguns did the same thing. All shoguns in Japan are, supposedly, descendants of Minamoto no Yoritomo, even though some of those connections are astonishingly tenuous. The political tradition is to emphasize continuity over rupture. In Japan, even when you stage a coup, you try to find a common ancestor, and you try to depict your coup as a return to origins. But even with that emphasis on continuity, when we study the transition from the first shogunate to the second, we do see change. And in particular, we see the emergence of a new samurai culture, including different approaches to morality, law, and society in general. So let's go back briefly to the Kamakura regime, the shogunate that emerged from the Ritsuryo state. The Ritsuryo system. Now, many warrior legal documents refer to sho or shōen. And you'll recall that sho were landed estates. They were exempt from Ritsuryo taxes and inspections. But those very exemptions made them part of the Ritsuryo system. Think, for example, of a modern tax shelter, maybe in the Cayman Islands. That sort of tax shelter only makes sense if the IRS is powerful. If there's no intrusive IRS, then why would you move your money to the Cayman Islands? So in that sense, Kamakura warrior culture was still a part of the ancient imperial state. The old order influenced the structure and the behavior of the Kamakura shogunate. But that's just not true for later shoguns. They were much less interested in trying to work around the edges of the old imperial state. They still deferred to the emperor when needed, but they began setting up their own forms of taxation and their own forms of control. Now, the Kamakura regime, interestingly, was run largely by descendants of Minamoto no Yoritomo's wife, Hojo Masako. They were powers behind the throne, just like the Fujiwara had been behind-the-scenes rulers during the Heian period. In fact, it tells you how much the first shoguns were still connected to court culture. The Hojo ruled as regents to child shoguns, just like the Fujiwara had ruled over emperors. But in the late 1200s, the Hojo hit a string of serious troubles. There were internal divisions within the Hojo family, and there was incompetent leadership. But their big challenge came in the form of two attempted invasions by the Mongols, one in 1274 and one in 1281. As you probably know, at its peak, the The Mongol Empire was enormous, stretching from Eastern Europe, through the Middle East, through Russia and Central Asia, to Korea and China. But the Mongols did not conquer Japan. Now, there are several explanations. The most mystical is that the kamikaze, a divine wind, destroyed the Mongol fleet. And that story was promoted by temples and shrines, claiming credit for the Mongol defeat. But a more practical explanation is that while the Mongols were terrifying as warrior horsemen of the steppes, they were terrible sailors. In fact, their ships were built by Korean slave labor. Now, the Mongol invasion in 1274 was repelled by Japanese samurai with great difficulty. So in its wake, Japanese defenders built stone walls around Hakata Bay. That was where the Mongols had landed in 1274, and it's where they tried to land again in 1281. But in 1281, they were unable to land. Some of the most fearsome warriors in Asia were stuck on their ships. They did manage to regroup and land on the small island of Takashima, near the modern city of Karatsu. But before the Mongols could mount an invasion of the main islands, their fleet was destroyed by a typhoon. So, perhaps the typhoon was divine, but it certainly helped that the Mongols could not get off their ships. Now, you might think that victory over the Mongols would have enhanced the power of the Hojo, but in fact, it created a problem. You see, the fighting against the Mongols was in Kyushu, in southwestern Japan, far from the Hojo center of power in Kamakura. So the Hojo relied heavily on warriors from the southwest region, and that strengthened the bond between local commanders, who were called shugo, and the local samurai. But even worse, the Hojo had nothing to offer as rewards. In domestic conflicts, you could offer samurai the land of defeated Japanese warriors. But the Hojo couldn't exactly offer land in Mongolia. And for most samurai, warm words of thanks from Kamakura were not the reward they had in mind. So the Hojo come out of the Mongol invasions, attempted Mongol invasions, seeming both remote and stingy. But what finished off the Hojo, the immediate cause of the fall of the Kamakura shogunate, was an ambitious emperor and a succession dispute in the 1330s. And I hope that sounds familiar because the turmoil of the 1330s does have some strong parallels to both the 1150s and the 1180s. On both occasions, two factions of the imperial line got into a fight, and the real winner was a third party. In fact, in both cases, the struggle within the imperial house left warriors more powerful and the imperial court weaker. Now, in the 1330s, the emperor was an ambitious individual named Go-Daigo. And Go-Daigo, or Daigo II. And his goal was to restore the imperial court to its former glory, to reestablish direct imperial rule. And Go-Daigo insisted that the Hojo let him choose his own successor as emperor. I'm sure that sounds reasonable, an emperor choosing his own heir. But that was not, in fact, the custom of the day. On the contrary, there had been an ongoing power struggle between two factions in the imperial house. That struggle had started as a fight between two brothers, and it just wouldn't go away. The Hojo had been containing the problem by having the two sides take turns. Each faction got to name every other emperor. And as part of this turn-taking, Emperor Go-Daigo was supposed to bequeath the throne not to his own son, but to the other line. But Go-Daigo wouldn't do it. He was determined to put his own son on the throne. And when the Hojo insisted otherwise, Go-Daigo called for the overthrow of the Hojo. Now, the Hojo were furious, and they sent Go-Daigo into internal exile. But Go-Daigo escaped and managed to get enough support to challenge the Hojo. Remember, The Hojo had antagonized lots of warrior families and many regional commanders. Shugo thought the Hojo were weak and stingy and remote. And with Go-Daigo's call to arms, these disgruntled samurai could attack the Hojo in the name of a higher purpose. What could have been called treason against the Hojo could now be described as loyalty to Emperor Go-Daigo. And that was a great pretext for settling old scores. So, in 1333, Go-Daigo's supporters crush the Hojo, and Go-Daigo gets to name his own heir. And everything should have gone well, but then Go-Daigo made the mistake of taking his own rhetoric too seriously. Go-Daigo seems to have envisioned a true restoration of imperial power. And to that end, he refused to appoint any of his warrior allies as shogun. He imagined that the imperial court could return to its former glory before the first shogunate. That did not endear him to his allies. In particular, the shugo, Ashikaga Takauji made the reasonable assumption that since he had helped restore Go-Daigo to power, Go-Daigo would make him shogun, or at least give him some grand reward. But Go-Daigo did not. And this ended very badly for Go-Daigo. To make a long story short, Ashikaga Takauji turned against Go-Daigo. He expelled him from Kyoto, and he replaced Go-Daigo's heir with a prince from the rival line of the imperial house. And this new emperor, in a completely unexpected move, named Ashikaga Takauji shogun. Utterly shocking. In exile, Go-Daigo's faction established their own imperial court. It was called the Southern Court. And the Southern Court held out until 1392, but without any real power. Today's Japanese emperors are descendants of what was called the Northern Court. Now, Ashikaga Takauji based his shogunate in the Muromachi district of Kyoto, and it lasted on paper until 1573. But the shogunate never lost that initial smell of treason. Every Ashikaga shogun's worst fear was that his own allies would behave like Ashikaga Takauji. And it's hard to run a dynasty where the implicit message is, please don't behave like our founder. Now, there was a brief flowering of Ashikaga power under the third shogun, Ashikaga Yoshimitsu, in the late 1300s and in the early 1400s. But by and large, the 1400s were characterized by weak shoguns and a weak imperial court. And here's a good example of the limits of Ashikaga power. In 1441, the sixth Ashikaga shogun, Ashikaga Yoshinori, angered a shugo by taking some of his holdings. So the shugo invited Yoshinori to a performance of no theater and murdered him. And the Ashikaga were so weak, they didn't even retaliate. So in terms of political control, this is a low point in Japanese history. The historian James Murdoch famously described the 1400s as the golden age, not merely of turncoats, but of mediocrities. But what's striking about the 1400s is that it was actually a golden age, not politically, but culturally. Many Japanese cultural forms that we now consider traditional are products of this era. For example, Japanese tea ceremony and Zen rock gardens. Those are both largely products of the 1400s and 1500s. Haiku poetry also has its origins in this period. It emerged from Renga poetry, a form of link verse that thrived in the 1400s. Moreover, the Ashikaga shoguns, especially Yoshimitsu, were great patrons of theater. In fact, no theater, now considered the most rarefied form of Japanese theater, developed during the 1400s. And here's a good example from architecture. If you stay at a ryokan, a traditional Japanese inn, that layout especially the design of the drawing room, with a recessed alcove for a hanging scroll and a flower arrangement. That design, that's from the 1400s. We'll discuss all of these cultural elements, tea ceremony, gardens, architecture, poetry, and theater in upcoming lectures. For now, though, we just want to take note of the fact that a great cultural flourishing occurred under the Ashikaga shogunate, and that it happened at a time when Japan was, politically speaking, rather weak. Now, this might seem initially like a paradox. The Ashikaga had limited power. They didn't really control much of Japan. Their regime is characterized by treason and betrayal and murder. How could this be an era of great cultural flowering? But if you think about it, it's not strange at all. Think of Italy in the same period. The Medicis only directly controlled Florence, just a little bit of what's now Italy. And Lorenzo de' Medici, he managed to rule not through overwhelming force, but through a combination of brutality, subtle coercion, and skillful diplomacy. And all the while, he was patronizing artists like Leonardo da Vinci, Michelangelo, Botticelli. So we might say that Ashikaga Yoshimitsu, the third shogun, was Japan's Lorenzo de' Medici, savvy in backroom political intrigue, ruthless when he needed to be, and a great patron of the arts. He was also, like Lorenzo de' Medici, a tough act to follow. His successors, like poor Yoshinori, tended to get either manipulated, ignored, or assassinated. Now that's what's remarkable about Yoshimitsu. He's the ruler of a weak shogunate, but he knew better than to base his authority solely on shogunal authority. He did a great job of flattering imperial courtiers and ingratiating himself with the imperial house. There's even a theory that he was planning to get control of the imperial court. Like many rulers in Japanese history, he chose to retire at the peak of his power and to rule from behind the throne. And in his retirement, he demanded many of the ceremonies usually accorded a retired emperor. We even find references to Yoshimitsu as the emperor's adoptive father, and to Yoshimitsu's wife as the emperor's surrogate mother. So Yoshimitsu was able to hold the shogunate together by playing courtier on the one hand and warrior on the other. But out in the countryside, things unfolded somewhat differently. In fact, another paradox of the 1300s and 1400s is that while practical politics were characterized by treason, that turmoil actually produced its own antidote. Because in the 1400s, we begin to see samurai defining themselves with a cult of extreme loyalty. And they began developing a new sense of samurai valor that was independent of courtier culture. One of the most famous examples of warrior loyalty comes from an epic of the 1300s. It's called the Taiheiki, and that literally means an account of great peace. And that title, by the way, is ironic, because the story of the Taiheiki is anything but peaceful. It's the story of the overthrow of the Hojo and Ashikaga Takauji's rise to power. One of the main characters in the Taiheiki is Kusunoki Masashige. He fought for the losing side. He stuck with Emperor Go-Daigo, and he fought against Ashikaga Takauji. Now, much of the basic chronology in the Taiheiki is accurate, but it's embellished with wonderful, imagined dialogue between warriors. And although the Taiheiki was written only about 200 years after the tale of the Heike, it offers a completely different vision of warrior culture. Unlike the tale of the Heike, warriors in the Taiheiki don't defer to courtier sensibilities. Instead, they act based on what's right for warriors. And what's right for warriors above all is loyalty. Not a rarefied sense of honor or privilege, but a rough and rugged sense of duty. And here's a good example. In the tale of the Heike, when Atsumori flees, Kumagai calls him out and says, It's cowardly to turn your back on the enemy. And Atsumori comes back, and then Kumagai kills him. Now in the Taiheiki, we get a completely different sense of honor. Kusunoki Masashige, the great hero of the epic, he retreats all the time. That's one of his signature strategies. He retreats if he's outnumbered. He retreats to confuse the enemy. He also retreats to lure the enemy into a trap. In fact, he retreats whenever there's a tactical advantage in retreating. In the Taiheiki, Masashige explicitly declares, if I stand and fight when I am outnumbered, and then I lose, and then I die, then I can't fight anymore to serve my lord. And Kusunoki Masashige rejected the idea that he was somehow supposed to indulge in a melodramatic show of honor. Instead, he focused on what for him was the real central issue: winning victories for his lord. In fact, in the Taiheiki, we get multiple instances of Masashige's deception and intrigue, but they are all legitimized by Masashige's loyalty to Emperor Go-Daigo. In one case, Kusunoki Masashige's fortress is surrounded by enemy soldiers, so he tricks the enemy into scaling the walls of the fortress. However, the outer walls of the fortress are fake, so then Kusunoki Masashige's men cut support ropes and the walls fall away, crushing the soldiers. And then he drives back another attack with boiling water. And finally, Masashige's enemies give up on attacks, and they lay siege to Kusunoki Masashige's castle, hoping to starve him out. So Masashige gathers his commanders and says, "Our duty is not to die here, but to survive to fight another day. So rather than fight when we are surrounded and outnumbered, I want to fake my own death. I want to give the appearance of having committed suicide. And that way, we will get the enemy to drop their guard, and then we can escape. Then we will regroup and attack again." And his men say, "Great idea. Forget about a suicidal last stand in the name of honor. Let's get out of here and then smash the enemy another day." Another aspect of the striking shift away from courtier sensibilities is Kusunoki Masashige's attitude towards Buddhism. Masashige's death scene in the Taiheiki is almost anti-Buddhist. Masashige and a dozen officers and their 60 retainers are surrounded by thousands of enemy soldiers. And Masashige understands that this is his last stand. He is worn out. So Masashige turns to his brother and says, "Brother, they say that your thoughts at your last moment determine whether your next life is going to be good or bad. So tell me, brother, what is your wish for rebirth?" Now, the correct answer here is, "I would like to be reborn at a higher level of enlightenment. I want to be reborn closer to Buddhahood. So therefore, I want to die with a calm mind, free from worldly desires." But Kusunoki Masashige's brother answers instead, "I would like to be reborn in the human realm 7 times so that I can destroy the imperial enemy." And Masashige responds, "That is a truly sinful, evil thought, but I think exactly as you do. So let us be reborn in the same way and let us realize our wish." And then they commit ritual suicide. Now this is an explicit embrace of Buddhist sin. Masashige does not want an auspicious rebirth. He wants to be reborn to kill more. And it's a striking contrast with Kumagai's response in the tale of the Heike. Kumagai was so overcome with grief at killing Atsumori that he lamented being a warrior at all. And he became a monk. Kusunoki Masashige serves an opposite impulse. Now this new image of the warrior does not come out of nowhere. Remember that Benkei in the Legends of Yoshitsune was also defined by extreme loyalty. And Masashige, like Benke, is seen as tough and rugged and burly. None of this elegant refinement of the imperial court. But Benke was the sidekick in Heike Monogatari. Whereas in Taiheiki, Kusunoki Masashige is an important commander, a direct servant of the emperor. And this new sense of warrior valor had a lasting impact on broader Japanese culture. Loyalty was always an important value for warriors. But in stories like the Taiheiki, it became the most important value. And this new sense of loyalty is more abstract. Benkei was incredibly loyal to Yoshitsune, but their bond was deeply personal. It was like an intense friendship. But Masashige is not buddies with Godaigo. The emperor is too far above him. Masashige dies not for Godaigo as a person, but for his lord as an abstraction. Masashige dies for a noble cause. And so in future generations, Masashige would be celebrated as a model of loyalty for its own sake. In fact, in World War II era propaganda, when the Japanese government wanted soldiers to die for an emperor they'd never met, they invoked Kusunoki Masashige. And kamikaze pilots were exhorted to follow Masashige's example. One kamikaze group was called Seven Lives, after Masashige's desire to die seven times for his lord. But for all the power of the Kusunoki Masashige legend, it built on earlier samurai legends, rather than replacing them. And for all of Masashige's propaganda power, he still can't touch the pop icon status of Minamoto no Yoshitsune. In fact, even in cases of the kamikaze, we find references to Yoshitsune. For example, the kamikaze were associated with cherry blossoms. That's a symbol of death and the flower of youth. And that's an association with Yoshitsune. There's nothing flower of youth about Kusunoki Masashige. And that brings us back to our opening point. Japanese samurai culture, having evolved over centuries, is not a single codified, timeless thing. Instead, it's made up of layers of stories and legends and different examples of heroism. Different views of what it is to be noble and brave. And those sometimes conflicting visions continue to shape Japanese culture.
Lecture 10, Japan at Home and Abroad, 1300 to 1600.
In this course, we've been thinking of the sweep of Japanese history in terms of waves of globalization and isolation. As we've seen, the first wave of globalization took place from the 500s to the 800s. That was followed by a period of relative isolation, running from around the 900s to around 1300. Today, we come to Japan's second great wave of globalization, which stretched from the 1300s to the early 1600s. Now, there are some strong parallels between Japan's first and second waves of globalization. In the first wave, Japan moved from fragmentation to centralization, as the Soga clan employed continental ideas and technologies to address the threat posed by rising dynastic powers in both China and Korea. And similarly, the second wave of globalization began in the 1300s with a fragmented and decentralized Japan. But by the 1590s, Japan again had a powerful centralized state, probably the most powerful Japanese central government since the 9th century. And once more, that process of centralization was driven by broader trends in East Asia. This time around, the powerful new dynasty in China was the Ming Dynasty. The canonical dates for the Ming are 1368 to 1644. A strong dynasty also emerged on the Korean Peninsula, the Yi Dynasty, which lasted from 1392 until 1910. So let's pick up Japan's story in the 14th century. You'll recall that the Ashikaga shogunate had been established in the 1330s after Ashikaga Takauji turned against Emperor Go-Daigo. This led to a situation where there were two rival imperial courts, a northern court in Kyoto and a southern court in Yoshino. Moreover, the Ashikaga shoguns were relatively weak. So in the 1300s and 1400s, Japan was racked by civil strife. But in China, the Ming Dynasty was consolidating its power. And as part of that consolidation, China reached a new level of prosperity. And East Asia underwent an unprecedented surge in the movement of people, goods, and ideas. That surge in trade gave Japanese merchants new opportunities for trade, but also new opportunities for plunder. Because in the absence of any strong central government, large parts of Western Japan, especially Kyushu, became a haven for pirates. These pirate bands were massive, hundreds, sometimes even thousands of ships, and they would attack coastal cities and strip them bare. These pirates were called wako, meaning Japanese pirates. But as pirates, they were not sticklers for questions of national identity. They did not ask for your birth certificate. These were thoroughly cosmopolitan pirates, and they raided Japanese cities too. Now, both China and Korea were alarmed by piracy, and they sent envoys to Japan to urge the Japanese government to suppress the wako. But there was no government in Japan powerful enough to do so. In fact, these foreign envoys were not even sure who was in charge in Japan. When the Ming Dynasty sent envoys in 1369 and 1370, the envoys followed ancient precedent. They landed in Kyushu and they were received in Dazaifu, near present-day Fukuoka. But Dazaifu was in the hands of the southern court, Emperor Go-Daigo's side. And the Ming envoys assumed that this was the ruler of Japan. Now, the Chinese imperial court had a distinctive view of the world. They saw Chinese emperors as unique and supreme, appointed by heavenly mandate. And all other rulers in the world, they were lesser monarchs. They were kings, but not emperors. And those kings, they ruled at the behest of the Chinese emperor. Now, if a regional monarch agreed to recognize the Chinese emperor as his sovereign, then China would allow trade. So trade was a reward for subservience to the Chinese throne. Well, way back in the 600s, the Japanese imperial court had pushed back against this worldview. They had insisted that the Japanese emperor was in fact the equal of the Chinese emperor. But in the 1300s, the southern court, while still proud, was weak. And they tried to finesse the issue. They tried to establish relations with the Ming without being overtly subordinate. And then, in 1372, Dazaifu fell to the Ashikaga shogunate. So when Ming envoys arrived later that year, they discovered that they might have been working with the wrong Japanese government. There was another Japanese government in Kyoto. And the Ming emperor became both confused and angry because his own envoys couldn't tell him who was in charge in Japan. And they couldn't even find someone to suppress the pirates. This question was not sorted out until around 1401. And that was when the third Ashikaga shogun, Ashikaga Yoshimitsu, began sending suitably respectful letters to the Ming court. He'd referred to himself as your subject, the King of Japan. Now that was a dicey proposition because Yoshimitsu did not want to publicly declare within Japan that he was subordinating himself to a foreign king. But subordination was lucrative. Not only did Yoshimitsu get lavish gifts from China, but he got trading rights. And he could sell the trading rights to merchants. And that was an important source of income. Now, later Ashikaga shoguns went back and forth on this question of how to deal with the Ming. Yoshimitsu's own son, Yoshimochi, denounced his father's actions. But then later Ashikaga shoguns returned to Yoshimitsu's model. And they did accept investiture as King of Japan from the Ming Emperor. Eventually, however, the entire question of the Ashikaga and the Ming became irrelevant because the Ashikaga became too weak to matter. Yoshimitsu was arguably the most powerful shogun of the Ashikaga dynasty. So he was able to capture some pirates and send them to China as prisoners. But later Ashikaga shoguns, they could not control the periphery. They couldn't even control the pirates. They couldn't even control their own lords. In 1441, the sixth Ashikaga shogun was assassinated in his own capital by an angry vassal. And then in the 1460s, under the eighth shogun, Japan slid into open civil war. Different local warlords or daimyo simply ignored the shogunate. This fighting within Japan affected relations with China, because daimyo, who were fighting each other in Japan, started fighting each other in China as well. The most spectacular incident occurred in 1523, when ships from two rival Japanese daimyo arrived in the Chinese port of Ningbo at the same time. And they started arguing over who was going to unload and sell their cargo first. Now, since there was a civil war back home, their argument turned into a melee in the streets of Ningbo, with Japanese samurai killing each other, burning ships, raiding storehouses, and, for good measure, killing Chinese port officials, before leaving and returning to Japan. This did not make the Chinese leadership happy. And the Ming insisted that the perpetrators be extradited to China for punishment. But remember, back in Japan, there's no one who could possibly enforce an extradition order. So in the end, the Ming just cut off trade. They stopped diplomatic relations with Japan, and remarkably, Japan, for the Ming, became just a dangerous, lawless nation. A country of outlaws. The Korean royal court was also struggling with the problem of civil war in Japan, and also with the problem of the Wakko. The Korean court realized that many of the pirates attacking Korea were based on a single island, Tsushima, which lies between Japan and Korea. And therefore, the Korean court asked the daimyo of Tsushima, the Seoul family, to suppress the Wakko. That, however, proved to be a task that the Seoul either couldn't or wouldn't do. So the Korean king sent his navy to attack Tsushima. And in 1419, Korea defeated the Seoul. And then an interesting thing happened. The Seoul agreed that they would take the necessary steps to suppress the pirates, and in return, they were granted special trading rights in the Korean port of Busan. Now think about how this reflects both globalization and Japanese decentralization. The local lord of Tsushima arranged an international trade deal with the king of Korea without any prior consultation with the shogun or the emperor. In fact, the 1420 treaty between the Seoul and the Korean court established something of a precedent. Tsushima maintained a special role in Japanese-Korean relations until the 1860s. Now, that independence of daimyo was one of the defining features of the 1400s. Local lords had been growing more and more powerful ever since the 1200s, but in the 1400s, their power eclipsed that of both the shogunate and the emperor. And daimyo began to act as though they were independent governments. They recruited their own samurai as vassals. They wrote their own laws. They set up toll barriers and checkpoints at their borders. In fact, the word daimyo itself is striking, because a direct translation of daimyo is great name. Until the 1400s, local lords had commonly referred to themselves using titles granted by the shogun, titles like shugo, meaning military governor. But in the 1400s, warlords increasingly used the title of daimyo, which did not refer to any higher authority. You became a daimyo by raising a large army and controlling a lot of territory, not through an appointment by the shogun. So daimyo were actually a new type of warlord, one that arose because of a power vacuum in Kyoto. And other new institutions were created as well. Cities assumed responsibility for their own defense, and so did villages, which were often led by local samurai, known as jizamurai, or samurai of the land. The welfare of jizamurai was bound up with the local farms they controlled, so their loyalty was primarily to a village rather than to a higher lord. But one of the most daunting new political forms to come out of this period of civil conflict was the ikoiki. These were networks or alliances of farm villages with their own jizamurai, and they were bound together by belief in true Pure Land Buddhism. Crucially, the ikoiki recognized only the authority of Ishiyamahonganji, a massive temple complex in Osaka. And because the ikoiki recognized a temple rather than a daimyo as their lord, many of their samurai were also monks. In fact, in the turmoil of the 1400s and 1500s, the distinction between farmer and warrior and monk in many cases disappeared. And the ikoiki were fearsome because they couldn't be intimidated. Let's think hypothetically. As a daimyo invading another daimyo's territory, your goal was often to kill as few farmers as possible because those farmers, those could be your future taxpayers. So you wanted to defeat the samurai army, but keep the farmers. In fact, ideally, you wanted the other daimyo to surrender and become your vassal. And you might even offer your enemy generous surrender terms if you wanted his help in fighting yet another daimyo. Now, daimyo felt obliged to fight hard to prove their courage. But after they had demonstrated their determination, they could consider joining forces against a common enemy. But none of this worked with the ikoiki. Whether their fighters were samurai or monks or commoners, they wouldn't surrender and join an enemy vassal band because they were convinced that they were going to be reborn in the Pure Land because of their faith in Amida. In short, they would rather die than join forces with non-believers. So the fighting against the ikoiki was incredibly tough because they fought to the bitter end. But even in the face of these developments, the trajectory of domestic Japanese affairs began to change in the mid-1500s. And above all, we can see a steady progress towards political consolidation. Now, this progress was shaped by the deeds of three daimyo who are typically known as the three great unifiers. Oda Nobunaga, who lived from 1534 to 1582. Toyotomi Hideyoshi, who lived from 1537 to 1598. And Tokugawa Ieyasu, who lived from 1543 to 1616. These are the men who unified Japan after a century of civil war. So let's start with Oda Nobunaga. By the time of his death in 1582, Oda Nobunaga had brought the central third of Japan under his control, a broad area around the traditional capital of Kyoto. And by 1590, Toyotomi Hideyoshi had beaten every other warlord in Japan into submission. Now, this period of unification, or reunification, began in the 1560s. One commonly cited date is 1568. That's when Oda Nobunaga took control of Kyoto in the name of the Ashikaga. But at roughly the same time, we have a strange new influence in Japan, a new and disruptive influence, the arrival of a different type of foreigner. The Portuguese in 1542, followed by the Spanish soon after, and then the Dutch and the English. Now, these strange foreigners, who by Japanese standards ate too much meat and did not bathe nearly enough, brought two remarkable things to Japan: guns and Christianity. Now, we'll talk about Christianity in another lecture, but let's take a moment now to explore the role that guns played in Japan's unification process. At the most basic level, European guns accelerated an existing trend in warfare away from individual acts of valor and towards large-scale mobilizations of forces in complex formations. Now, even before the introduction of firearms, commanders were already exploring different ways to combine large numbers of archers, lancers, pikemen, and other warriors. But guns pushed this even further. Now, technically, guns were not new to Japan. There had been Chinese guns in circulation, but Western guns had nearly triple the range, and these weapons were devastating, but only if deployed correctly. The early matchlocks brought over by the Portuguese and the Spanish, they were still hard to aim, and they were slow to reload, and they were prone to misfire. So in one-on-one combat, it would be better to have a sword. But if you organize your gunners in teams so that they could concentrate their fire, and if you had one group fire while the other was reloading, then you had a devastating addition to your army. The most famous instance of this new use of weapons is the Battle of Nagashino, where Oda Nobunaga and Tokugawa Ieyasu destroyed one of the most powerful warlord houses in Japan, the Takeda. The battle is not only the basis of the Kurosawa movie, Kagemusha, it's also featured in several video games, and it's commemorated in a famous screen painting. The essence of the battle is that the Takeda were certain that their cavalry charge would drive the enemy's infantry to break ranks and scatter. But instead, their cavalry was destroyed by volleys of gunfire from men who were sheltered behind simple pickets. This battle effectively turned the calculus of war upside down. Because think of how long it takes to learn to be a mounted archer or even a mounted lancer, and consider the cost of supporting a mounted warrior compared to the cost of training associated with a gunner who just holds his position and fires. The cultural impact of this cannot be overstated. Think of it this way. Contrast the Battle of Nagashino with its massive volleys of gunfire. Contrast that with the one-on-one combat of Atsumori and Kumagai in the Tale of the Heike. So technology began to force a reevaluation of samurai valor. But Oda Nobunaga's bloodiest fighting was not at Nagashino. It wasn't even against other warlords. It was against the Iko Iki. The problem with the Iko Iki was, as we've noted, they just would not submit. Nobunaga could offer other warriors a choice: join my forces against a common enemy and be rewarded, or oppose me and be destroyed. And the more Nobunaga won, the more it made sense simply to submit. But for the Iko Iki, dying meant going to heaven. So by some accounts, Nobunaga killed over 30,000 Iko Iki adherents in the Northeast before they gave in. Nobunaga was battle-hardened, but even he was astonished by the slaughter. There are so many corpses, he declared, that there is room for no more. Later, Nobunaga turned his attention to Ishiyama Honganji, the Ikkō-iki's head temple. But it took a 10-year siege from 1570 to 1580 for him to force a surrender there. Now, Oda Nobunaga died in 1582, and he was succeeded by Toyotomi Hideyoshi, who, by 1590, had forced all the daimyo in Japan to swear loyalty to him. From the far northeast to the far southwest, all of modern Japan except Hokkaido and Okinawa. Hideyoshi was the supreme Japanese warlord. But he had still greater ambition. Indeed, he went so far as to express his desire to be Emperor of China and then to conquer the entire world. Now, those proclamations are so grand that it might be wise to take them as hyperbole. But did Hideyoshi really expect to conquer all of China? Some historians think he was just seeking a better trade deal from the Ming, or maybe hoping to conquer the southeast parts of Korea. But whatever his master plan, Hideyoshi did, as we'll see in a moment, launch an invasion on the continent. And his preparations for that overseas empire had important consequences for Japanese culture. Hideyoshi wanted to make sure that he would not face domestic trouble while he was fighting abroad, and the result was the most powerful and the most centralized Japanese state since the 800s. Hideyoshi demanded systematic land surveys in Japan, the first nationwide survey since the 800s. All daimyo were supposed to report to him their land holdings. And he aggressively moved daimyo around, rewarding some with larger holdings and punishing others with smaller holdings. He claimed control over all the gold mines in Japan. He minted coins for the first time since the 900s. For centuries, Japan had relied on foreign coins. He collected weapons from commoners, and he gave two reasons. One was that the weapons would be melted down and used to create a giant Buddha, bringing good fortune to those whose metal was used. And second, here he was a bit more honest, he noted that unarmed peasants would be less likely to cause trouble. Hideyoshi also issued bans on the change of social status. Peasants were not to leave their villages, and especially not to join warrior bands. And warriors were not to leave their vassal bands to become cultivators. He froze the social fluidity that had been one of the hallmarks of Japan during this time of civil strife. Now, here's a great honor. Hideyoshi himself was of humble origins, but that likely made him aware of just how much trouble a motivated peasant could cause. When it came to religion, however, Hideyoshi was extremely pragmatic. Oda Nobunaga had destroyed Ishiyama Honganji for opposing his rule, but Hideyoshi could afford to be more lenient and practical. He allowed the remaining followers of True Pure Land Buddhism to rebuild Honganji Temple, provided they recognized his authority and built a simple temple complex, not a massive fortress. And Hideyoshi was also tolerant of Christianity, if it served his purposes. For example, he was happy to have Christian daimyo lead his invasion of Korea. So, having built a powerful state to support his international ambition, Hideyoshi embarked on his grand plan. His troops landed in Korea in May of 1592, and these were battle-hardened veterans, and they overran much of Korea in a matter of months. But the tide of battle turned when the Ming dynasty intervened on behalf of their ally, the Yi dynasty. And Ming forces pushed Hideyoshi's men back to around the 39th parallel, where the two sides became deadlocked. They negotiated a truce, and they tried to conclude a peace treaty. And yes, indeed, there are some eerie similarities here between the 1590s and the 1950s. At any rate, peace talks did not go well. Hideyoshi's ambassadors could not even convey his demands to